Hi, everyone. Welcome to Televisions, the podcast, an audio companion to the Televisions website and a show made by Anglophiles for Anglophiles. I am Lacey Bargamilis, and I'm the editor here at Televisions. And joining me, as usual, is my co-host, Miss Annie Bundle.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm stressed.
Oh.
I just have like a to-do list that's like 87 miles long, and I feel like I'm already behind because I had COVID and, you know, was sick. And the list just kept getting longer, and it doesn't appear to be getting any shorter anytime soon.
It's okay. It will all get done, and if it doesn't get done, it wasn't that important to begin with.
Thanks, Mom.
You're welcome.
She's right.
What are we talking about today?
Well, as you may have guessed from that third voice, we have a guest with us today, and it is our contributor Sophie Brookover, who is here to help us do an episode that we all really wanted to do. I'm just not sure how it's going to go over or how it's going to go, just sort of full stop. But we are going to do another installment in our British movie series and talk about a film called Saltburn. It is written and directed by Emerald Fennell, who many of you will remember as Nurse Patsy from Call the Midwife. She's also behind another very disturbing and difficult to talk about film, which is called Promising Young Woman. She's incredibly talented.
She was pregnant Barbie Midge in Barbie.
She was pregnant Barbie Midge, which was actually a real Barbie, by the way, for people who don't know that. And this movie, it's hard to talk about this movie. We were originally planning to do this episode last week because we thought Saltburn was going to get nominated for some Oscars, but it did not.
Apparently, there's not a sicko contingent.
Yeah, the sicko contingent is on this podcast.
But doesn't vote for the Academy Awards.
Before we start, a little heads up for all and sundry who fast-forwarded through the opening bit that we do before we start talking on the show. This episode, this film, this experience, there's a reason we keep joking about sickos when we talk about this movie, because this movie is very divisive. It's very difficult in a lot of ways in terms of the subject matter that it deals with. It absolutely has what your mom would call adult themes. We are going to talk about a variety of potentially uncomfortable and adult subject matter, to include a wide variety of sexual themes and all kinds of stuff. If this is not for you, totes fine. Just turn it off. Come back. We'll be here next week. Like, this is, I don't know. We tried to think of a way to do this episode without all of this, and it is actually just impossible.
You can't talk about this movie and keep it PBS, guys. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. Even minus swearing, it would not work.
Yeah. If this is too TVMA for you, we will see you next week. If you hated this movie, maybe hang out and see why we liked it. But if you really just hated this movie and it's not for you, that's fine. You can skip this episode too. We'll be back with more, you know, PG content next week.
All right. So let us talk about Emerald Fennell's cross between Brideshead Revisited and The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yes, let's. I have I mentioned earlier that I have a very brief, like 15-word summary of the plot. Is now the moment to share that?
Yes, now is the moment to share that.
Okay, great.
All right, I've been really interested to see how she crammed all this into 15 words, so let's go.
Okay, so these are the words that I have written down on my little index card. Oxford. Awkwardness. Felix. Tenuousness. Saltburn. The Wacky Catton Family. And then redacted, because things get real weird.
I mean, that is, in the strictest sense, all true.
Exactly. And yet captures nothing about the film.
Okay, so basically, a really easy way to think of this is it starts out a little Brideshead. Okay, Barry Cohen is he plays a kid named Oliver who's kind of like the middle class kid going to the posh school. And he meets, meets and is a little in love with the really rich kid named Felix, who's played by Jacob Elordi, and sort of attaches himself to Felix, and you know, he tells him, you know, my dad's dead, you know, the overdose, drug addict parents, you know, I've had a really rough childhood. And Felix is like, well, come home with me to Saltburn, you know, since you don't have anywhere to go for the holidays, and come meet my family, you know, we'll take you in. And so, you know, this is, I love telling people this is a period piece set in 2003.
Set in 2007.
Hey, we just did a Classics Revisited on a movie from 2015. We are all getting old.
And so, you know, they go home to the extraordinarily wealthy family of Felix and their grand estate at Saltburn. And Rosamund Pike plays his mother. Allison Oliver plays his sister. Richard E. Grant is the lord of the manor. They are what is the name of the I don't remember the name. The other
Farley,
who is a, and they're basically, there's the bully friend.
But he's their cousin.
They're cousins. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually very important where he ranks in relation to their family.
Yes.
Right. He is their cousin, but is basically
he's American.
With them.
Is the thing that the thing that sticks out of him is that he's technically American.
No. It's the money thing.
Okay.
It's that Felix's parents are basically paying for him to go to school because his mom ran off to America, and he is a poor relation, basically.
And he's biracial and black. He can pass, as he says to Oliver, he's almost making it seem like he's one of them, but not quite. Farley's much better at it, because he's had a lot more practice. But he's basically, like, for all the Mansfield Park heads out there, he's basically the Fanny Price character.
Ah, there you go. And so the thing about Farley is that he knows that Oliver is the one he can pick on because Oliver really can't pass. And he totally, like, he the fact that he comes along too is sort of like Oliver's Oliver's nemesis is basically there. And so,
well, because the thing is about Farley is that he's the poor relation, but he still grew up in this world.
Right.
It's still very normal to him. He still has all the connections that Felix and his family have. Mm. He just doesn't have the money. Well, he doesn't have his own money. He has the money that the Cattons give him.
Right. Yeah, because his mom, right. So because the Sir James, Richard E. Grant's character, he's the one who is like, he's the head of the family, like the head of the extended family. So he's the one with all the money. He's been very reliant on the kindness of and generosity of the Cattons.
The kindness of strangers.
right. Who are his literal relatives. But yeah, yes, yes. And just to be clear, when we say that, like, Farley is passing or Oliver is not, we're not talking about racial identity here. We're talking strictly about, like, their position in terms of class and how successful or not they are at navigating, you know, a social milieu that is not like their native spot in that way. Like, has different.
I think it might be worth later coming back to the fact that this film has a very precarious understanding of racial dynamics.
Yes.
But it is a movie that is about class,
right.
Yeah,
not race.
I also think it's very important that, because Farley is actually underneath at the same level as Oliver, that he is the only one who's not taken in by Oliver.
Right.
All of Felix's family, from Felix to the sister, they all, you know, they all are completely taken in by Oliver.
It's not that. It's they enjoy poverty porn.
Yes.
Okay. That's a better way of putting it. Yes, thank you.
They enjoy the oddity of people like Oliver.
Yes, yes.
They enjoy the sort of salacious dirtiness of it that they can kind of, like, at from a distance and, like, get all up in there and see what it's like. But they don't actually have to, like, clean up the mess.
Right. They don't have to deal with it in any kind of substantive way. They don't even have to have any kind of real emotional response to it, like the way that a normal person would. They're just really obsessed with these like grimy details of Oliver's family life. And it's worth noting, like, that's something that Felix sort of drew out of him gradually when they first met. But within the first 5 seconds of his meeting Felix's parents, Lady Elspeth is like, so tell me, like, all about
your drug dealer mom.
Yeah. and the horrible, grimy facts of your existence in Liverpool, which is a city that none of us know where it is, even though we live in a fairly small country, as geography goes.
Right? I also think it's worth pointing out that Felix tends to have a habit of this. They reference several times that Oliver is kind of like his latest pet, basically.
Yeah.
That he had another one just like him the previous summer. And he actually, there's a moment towards the very beginning of the film where Oliver starts cleaning up Felix's dorm room, kind of like,
yes, oh my God,
forcing him to like kind of confront the fact that he's useless, and that they are very different from very different, you know, class strata, that in the way that they deal with something as simple as like leaving food out,
right.
And they kind of drift apart, or rather Felix pulls back from that until Oliver shows up to tell him that his dad died.
Yes.
And then once he's got some more suffering, like some more like poor people, you know, tourism for him to do, yeah, like Felix is right back in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. People like they're Felix. I think Felix does have a certain degree of innate kindness. Mm-hmm. That
I agree.
Basically nobody else in the family has, but he hasn't learned how to really be a person. And as a consequence, and because he has these sort of really terrible examples at home, I think the way that he's learned to deploy that is like by being sort of Lord Bountiful. Like the people, you know, to gain access to his company, you need to either be in the same social class and have attended like the same strata of schools that he did, or be kind of a needy lower class mess. Like those are the two options.
Yeah.
For people. And Oliver, like, who, you know, is immediately drawn to him, like at the beginning of the film, like the first week of school, he knows he can't do it on the basis of like what public boarding school he attended. He has to do it on the basis of
pity. You know, of it's pity, being, basically.
Yeah. Yes. But he doesn't grasp that immediately either. But we'll talk more about that later.
So I think the first quote unquote, let's say, disturbing thing that happens in this movie is when Oliver seduces the sister, his Venetia.
You want to go back?
Okay.
Bathtub happens first. Because I think I think before we can talk about anything else about this movie, that scene is obviously very disturbing. But I think in a larger sense, like, you can't really talk about this movie until you talk about Felix and Oliver's sort of relationship.
Yeah, they have
it is and what it isn't, right, and what it might be.
Yeah. So okay. Oliver is plainly obsessed with Felix, like from jump, to the point that he,
I mean, the movie literally starts with him being like, was I in love,
right,
with him?
Right.
Like, that's the first line of the movie.
So there's this framing device where Oliver kind of pops in to narrate certain bits along the way. And yeah, that the first one is him saying like, well, I loved him, but was I in love with him?
Or did I just want to be him?
Right. But yeah, the images that were being shown are just like Felix in the sort of permanent golden hour that follows him wherever he goes.
Right.
Just like, well, who wouldn't be? Like, if you're showing me a close-up of the back of this man's neck.
He's shirtless and, right, shining, and like water is sensuously,
exactly,
dripping down his torso.
There's a lot of glistening.
Lots of glistening.
There's a lot of it.
I have to say, because the only thing I'd seen Jacob Elordi in before this was the Euphoria show on HBO. And I have to say that this movie actually showed me what a good actor he is and how good he is at using his body to act.
Yeah.
and like be more than
decide if I think he's good looking or just tall.
He's not. That was the thing that this movie actually brought home to me, because the thing in Euphoria that has always bothered me is that he's not actually good looking, but Euphoria assumes that he is, and it's always weirded me out. This movie, he uses his body in such a way that it doesn't matter that he's not good looking. It's quite a trick.
I don't think he's not good looking. It's not like ugly.
He's not in the same way that Benedict Cumberbatch is not traditionally hot. He's not hot. You know?
Okay. Can we just all agree to disagree on that one? But I will say one thing that's very funny, Annie, is that you touched on, is he attractive or is he tall?
No, that was me, because I'm very confused by my feelings about it.
Oh, that was you. So as we record this, Jacob Elordi was the host of Saturday Night Live last week.
Oh, yes, that's true. He was.
And there's a literal sketch about that.
Is there really?
Yes,
there really is.
Yes, there really is.
What was the verdict? Well, is he hot or just tall?
Both, but more tall than hot. But because it's like a...
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad that my feelings are being validated right now, that other people have had this conflict.
Yes, it's the... The title of the sketch is like crowning our short king or something like that. And yeah, so it's about guys who are like normal height. And then, a last minute twist is, oh my God, the Jacob Elordi shows up and the woman, it's like a bachelor style dating show. She's like, nope, he wins. That's it. I don't need to hear anything else. We're done now.
Okay. There is a thing where you're right. I guess you don't realize it's disturbing at the time. Is that
no, it is extremely disturbing.
Okay. I didn't think it was disturbing at the time. Is when is the naked in the field scene, I guess.
Oh, nope. Sorry, I'm gonna have us back way up. The first disturbing thing that happens is on campus at Oxford, we see very early on that Oliver has a keen interest, let's say, in
voyeurism.
In observing, things that are not actually any of his business. But yeah, he likes to watch Felix having sex. And he does that on more than one occasion.
And then almost hooks up with the girl that he hooked up with.
Right, yes.
And it's very...
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
I mean, I guess I've just read enough like bad thriller novels that didn't twig for me as badly as like the bathtub thing. But
see, that didn't twig. And again, that didn't twig for me all that badly, because I have watched way too many bad. Like, I was just like, okay, yeah, no, that's.
Sorry, what are you watching where people are drinking other people's bath water, you weirdo?
Okay, no. The bathtub. Okay, the drinking of the semen in the bathtub is freaky, but the actual like watching him have sex with other girls and then hitting on those girls actually didn't bother me that much, because I was like, okay, that's kind of that standard gay repression stuff that doesn't actually, like, that didn't surprise me, because I was sort of thinking, the first time I watched this, I was thinking of this as an updated version of Bride's Head. And so I was like, yes, that's
I see what you're saying. It does. It
does have like real Bride's Head vibes though, except they sort of replaced the Catholic thing with like overt gayness.
Yes. And so to me, like, that would, that when I was when I watched it the first time and I thought of this as a total like Bride's Head remake for the early 21st century, you know, set in the aughts. I was like, yeah, OK, that tracks. I totally accepted that, because that's the kind of thing that you would get in that.
So Sophie looks unconvinced.
No. I'm sorry. That's my I'm sort of thinking rusty bitchy face. I'm thinking about it that way. Like, if in your mind you were mapping all of the, like, the characters and the story beats, you know, fairly directly to what happens in Bride's Head Revisited, that does make more sense for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, let's think about it. He does say that Evelyn Waugh based some.
Yes. Oh my God. Like,
his
novels
on the family.
Yeah, they say the quiet part out loud. I was like, oh, okay, fine. Good.
Yeah. And, you know, and honestly, that's why that the scene where he strips down in the field, that's sort of to me mapped onto the sunbathing naked on the roof. And yes, the bathtub scene is freaky when he gets in it, but I was just kind of like, okay, we're just gonna keep going way beyond what I was ready for, but okay. Up until then, it was actually when he then slept with the sister that I was like, okay, no, we're going someplace I wasn't prepared. Okay, that's why, for me, that was the moment where I was like, whoa, we've really gone off the tracks. Anyway, continue. Back to Oxford, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. We don't need to spend any further time in Oxford necessarily. I'm wondering if we should actually like skip to the end, give the reveal, and then work and then talk about things.
Yeah, probably.
Is that okay?
Probably. Yeah.
So basically, he sort of like seduces his way through the family.
We don't actually ever see him sleep with the mom,
literally and emotionally.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They're in ways both physical and not. And then Felix, who, as previously mentioned, has the capacity to be kind and thoughtful. In a genuine way, has arranged a lovely birthday surprise for Oliver, which is to take him home to Merseyside and see his mom, you know, and just see how she's doing. And it transpires that Oliver has been lying this entire time.
He's actually from like a quite nice neighborhood and his parents are lovely. Yeah, his dad is not dead.
Not
his
all.
Mom is not like a vomiting drug dealer.
No.
Like, he's made all of this up because he understands that that is the story. That's the him that Felix needed to see to like him.
Yes, yes. And he actually, like, says that out loud when they have a big confrontation later that evening at the birthday party that Felix's parents are throwing for Oliver. Of course, like, none of his friends are there.
Which is insane. That party is insane.
Yeah, it is a completely bananas Midsummer Night's Dream themed bacchanal. And so he confronts Felix about this because, of course, Felix is like, I can't believe that you were lying to me about this. This is appalling. Like, no,
this is like sick. Yeah, get out of my
house.
We're
not friends anymore. You're going to leave tomorrow after this birthday party. That's it.
Which is very funny in a way that like Felix does the thing that like he like gloms on to that central tenet of upper class Britishness, which is politeness.
Yes.
He is insanely like nice about it.
Yeah.
He's like, no, we're going to have this party because we've invited everyone and that's what we have to do. And you're just going to leave tomorrow. And that is how it is. He's relentlessly stiff upper lip about the whole thing.
Yes. And Oliver, you know, sort of has this howl of desperation in the middle of this argument that they have where, you know, he sort of screams at him, I only gave you what you wanted.
And it's true.
I'm sorry. And he says, I'm sorry, my performance wasn't good enough. And there's just Felix has absolutely no way to understand what any of that means. Like he just doesn't have the capacity at all. And next morning, he's dead. Felix is dead. They find his corpse in the enormous labyrinth. Everyone,
because of course this house has a gigantic hedge maze.
Huge.
It's that kind of
huge.
House.
And they have like a tiny model of the hedge maze in their library that like overlooks the actual hedge maze
in the room with the Shakespeare folio.
Yes.
And all the paintings of dead
yes,
Rallies.
That's right, but not the awful Rubens.
I love the house. I love his tour of the house.
Yes.
It's incredible.
And so basically what happens after that is that like Oliver having like seduced his way through the family, now basically kills his way through the family. So Felix is dead.
Yeah.
He sets it up so that Venetia takes her own life.
He basically manipulates
yes.
her, and he emotionally like manipulates her during her
yes.
grief. And,
yes.
Oh, he's gotten rid of Fairley by framing him for theft.
Yes.
And then
Sir James is kind of like, you have got to go. Like, you need to leave. We are not doing this anymore. And it's interesting. Oliver in that moment, like, has enough confidence that he kind of tries to, I don't know, like, there's a certain frostiness there that he tries to say, well, I simply cannot leave. I don't see how I possibly could. And
Elspeth needs
exactly.
me because Elspeth has, like, glommed on to him. Since, I mean, kind of understandably, since both of her kids have
yeah.
died suddenly and horribly.
Yes. Yes. So, but so he leaves, and it's not 100% clear whether Sir James has actually paid him off. I believe that he has because of what a beautiful home he has. When we flash forward 15 years to learn that Sir James has died, it seems based on contextual clues that he too has taken his own life. And, you know, he bumps into, very coincidentally, bumps into Lady Elspeth at this coffee shop, and they decide, oh, we're catching up. Isn't it nice? She invites him to Saltburn. And the next thing you know, she is in a coma and on an intubator. And it turns out that the framing device wasn't just like Oliver sort of reminiscing or maybe writing a memoir, or, I don't know, giving an interview somehow. Actually, he's just like evil villain monologuing to Lady Elspeth all that he did. That what happened that year?
It's like his confession. It's like his confession, yes, dial, basically, yes, to steal a Doctor Who, yes, phrase.
And then he extubates her and she dies. And because
and he gets
he
everything.
Inherits everything because, you know, when he came to visit her at Saltburn, you know, what with one thing and another, you know how it is. You're staying at your dead friend's enormous.
Your dead guy you had a crush on, mom's
right,
house.
Right, right. And low-key and low-key murdered. One thing leads to another. And the next thing you know, you are the sole heir of this massive fortune and estate. And when Lady Elspeth dies, what does one do but dance naked through the house in, like...
To a banging song.
Yes, yes. To the immortal classic Murder on the Dance Floor by Sophie Ellis Bextor.
Yeah, if you've heard that song in the past couple of months...
This is why.
Get a little more airplay, this is why. This movie is why.
Yeah, yeah. And he does it... I didn't realize this when I was watching it, but I read a little thing about the film that pointed out that the route he takes during his little nude dancing extravaganza...
Oh my gosh, is it Felix's tour?
It's the reverse
it's reversed.
Yeah.
Ah!
That's almost too frightfully clever, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
I kind of love that, honestly.
I liked that detail very much.
I don't even. There's so much to talk about.
It's such a rich text.
Movie.
Yeah. The reason that I wanted to sort of zoom through that is to then like jump backwards to talk about individual events.
Mm-hmm.
Because my hypothesis, having watched it in full two times, is that Oliver proves himself to be absolutely brilliant as like a, you know, a manipulator and a schemer.
Yeah.
Terrific improvisational skills on that score, because things do happen that he could not possibly have planned for. But I don't believe that he planned from their first meeting, which he orchestrated. We learn in hindsight that he orchestrated their first meet cute with Felix by puncturing his bicycle tire. But like the return on his investment of having punctured that tire and then generously offering his bike to Felix so that Felix doesn't miss an important tutoring session, is the ROI is so incredibly high. Felix announces that he loves him. Felix kisses him on the cheek. Like, why wouldn't he do more?
Yeah.
Like, he keeps being incentivized to do more and more things, to make these lies get bigger and bigger and wilder and wilder. Yeah, he just keeps doing these wilder and wilder things and escalating. And every time someone in the family confronts him, that prompts him to do ever more outre things.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really interesting. I had not noticed that when I was originally watching, because I, like a chump, didn't realize it was going to go in this talented Mr. Ripley direction.
I think a lot of how you feel about this movie, or at least about maybe the premise of this movie, is a little more correct, because Oliver does do just a crap ton of stuff, and I agree with you, Sophie. I don't actually think that this was premeditated from the jump. I don't know where I think I would put the pin that it happened, like that it turned into that. But I think a lot of how you feel about this is going to depend on how you feel about Felix and Oliver's relationship and what you think it is and how genuine you think Oliver's feelings for Felix are.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about this film that really got me is because as I said, I went in expecting this to be a Brideshead remake. And somewhere in the middle, it suddenly becomes The Talented Mr. Ripley. And I don't actually know when that happens. And, you know, I think that watching it a second time is actually the right thing to do, because that really does sort of help you realize that you can maybe pinpoint where that transition happens, where it stops being Brideshead and starts being Mr. Ripley.
Well, I would say that I don't think the split is that clean. I don't think it 100%. I mean, I will just put it out there that I fully believe that Oliver loved Felix.
Yeah.
And or in as much as Oliver is capable of loving anyone, but I fully believe in his feelings for him and that was genuine on his part. I don't think that we're going to have to talk about the grave scene at some point.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think you have that. I don't think you have that scene unless there is something there that is real. Like, that's not an act.
Yeah. No.
I think that there is a lot. Because now that I've watched it most way through twice, I do have a slightly different read on it, like my second time through, which is that I don't think that it is a Brideshead remake that suddenly becomes a Talented Mr. Ripley riff. I think those two things intertwine and sit side by side, because I think the reason that the Talented Mr. Ripley stuff starts happening is because Oliver loves him.
I think it's because Oliver loves him, and because once he's at Saltburn, he gets like the much fuller context of like where Felix is coming from, both literally and in terms of, you know, his worldview. And he can see, because of poor dear Pamela, which that is literally this character's name.
I know.
Great job by Carrie Mulligan.
I know, amazing. I hate the Pamela book, by the way.
But because of what happens to poor dear Pamela, and what he can see is happening with Farley. Like, I don't think he realized until he arrived the sort of what the full dynamic was between Farley and the rest of the Cattons. And he sees like, oh, it's tenuous even for Felix, and he is their blood relation who they've grown up with. And he's just, he very assiduously goes about, you know, basically things are tenuous. Well, he's going to be tenacious. Like, that's, he sort of makes up his mind to do that. And I think he just keeps going further and further and further into that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't actually think, I actually think the real switchover happens much later in the movie than my second time through, at least for sure. I think it happens much later, because I don't actually think he means to kill him in the garden. I think that ends up being like a total, like, I'm torn a little bit about maybe like, does he have to do this now that he knows the truth and it's the only way he can cover things up? Or if he legit thought that he could talk him round, you know what I mean? All of that feels very unplanned and desperate to me.
Okay, I do think he thought, A, that he could talk Felix round. I think, B, that Felix's big mistake is not coming home and immediately telling everybody what he learned.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
The fact that
I don't think anybody likes Felix for his smarts.
Yes, and it.
Yeah,
And it, the fact that Felix is like, you'll leave tomorrow. I'm like, the moment Felix said, you leave tomorrow, I was like, and you don't live tonight. And no, of course he didn't live that night. And that there's a level of, you know, and the grave scene, you know, my first reaction to the grave scene was, man, you really didn't want to kill him, did you? Aw, you poor thing. That's disgusting.
No, I fully in my soul believe that he loved him. And I don't know that I certainly don't think it was healthy.
No.
I don't think it was good for either of them, but I
obviously
think it was
not
very genuine.
Yeah.
I think it was very genuine. And I don't, like, Oliver doesn't strike me as a person that feels like that very often. So I think that sort of not having any idea where to put all those big feelings is also one of it.
Yeah. He, yes. That's, I think, the first time that we see, Well, I guess actually we see it, we glimpse a little of it in the car ride up to his house, like once he realizes that that's where Felix is taking him.
That panic is amazing.
Oh my God, yes. Yes, it was incredible.
And honestly, like that to me is one of the moments where I was like, that isn't worth an Oscar. Like, you guys aren't going to nominate that. That scene is so good. Anyway.
Yeah.
I have to say, but then of course you have the grave scene and there's no way. I know that's why the Academy couldn't vote for
it. Can we say what the grave scene consists of?
Go, Lacey. So Felix's funeral happens and Oliver attends with the immediate Catton family, and the ceremony is lovely. They sing, and this is really good. I've told so many people this story. Sorry if you've already heard it, but a lot of you know that I sing in church choir, and one of my favorite hymns, it's called Lord of All Hopefulness, which is the hymn that they play at Felix's funeral and also during the grave scene. It's also the music is from an Irish folk song. The name of this particular hymn is Lord of All Hopefulness. It's also the tune to Be Thou My Vision, which is another song I love. And so this beautiful, like, choral arrangement of Lord of All Hopefulness is playing. They go to the graveside. They stand there. We, like, lay Felix to rest. And then Oliver basically strips naked and lays himself to rest on top of Felix's grave. And there is some gyration and interaction with the grave that is extremely disturbing, and I haven't had to sing Lord of All Hopefulness since I saw this movie, and I just, when we get back round to singing that again, I am going to have to, like, I don't know, go to the bathroom or something. Like, it's just like, I'm just gonna have to hide. It's gonna be really difficult.
Yeah. So apparently that scene was, like, not written into the script originally.
Okay, so Deadline published the script, and what it is that what it actually reads is, I have it right here. Oliver falls to his knees. He is crying. He lays down on the dirt. He caresses the dirt where Felix's face would be. He strips naked. He lays back down. .. And that's all it says.
Yeah, the .. does a lot of work.
Yeah.
It really does. The ellipsis is the MVP of this movie.
Yeah.
Apparently a lot of that was sort of ad-libbed.
Yes.
Clearly.
What I have read.
Yes.
They just let Barry go.
Like, it's very, yes, it's very disturbing. Yes, I'm... Did it have to be that hymn? Yes, it is really, really over the top, but it is also really, like, visceral and raw in a way that you don't see Oliver experience much through this movie, because he is very in control of himself and his actions and how he reacts to things a lot. So, I mean, it's really, like, there's no way you could have that scene if he didn't love Felix, in my mind.
Anyway. Yeah, yeah. Whether that love...
Love can be toxic. Love can be toxic.
Exactly.
Too,
exactly.
But it doesn't make it not real.
The thing is that was one of those moments where I was just like, I can't actually believe I'm sitting in a theater watching this scene.
I just was sitting there being like, I'm so glad I came to this by myself. Because I don't think that I would have. Well, I actually did. Like, Greg and I have a very specific sort of, like, delineation of the movies that we will go see together. They're. Are what he refers to as Lacey movies, which is, he calls movies that I enjoy, which he says are full of awful and unlikable people. So I was like, let me go see this movie while Greg's out of town on a work trip, because he will not enjoy this movie. And I was like, I'm just so glad I don't have to watch someone else watch me watch this.
Yeah.
I went and saw this movie because I was reviewing it, and I was sitting by myself, because I always sit very far away from everybody when I review things, because I'm trying to take notes and I'm annoying, and I know that, like, people don't want to be near a person doing that. And I put down my pen and I just sat there with my jaw hanging open, like, this is where we are in 2023.
I'm literally like singing along with the hymn. I'm literally like humming along with the hymn under my breath before it like really gets going. And then I'm like, oh no.
Well, that's even better.
The own and the oh no.
It's beautiful music.
Oh no, it is beautiful music, but I would it's one of those, you know, like there are just times when I'm watching things, reviewing them, and I'm like, this is where we are in 20, like I think I've had that moment with The Handmaid's Tale a couple times where I'm like, this is what we watch for entertainment in the 2020s. I'm gonna have to explain this to somebody one day. And yeah, that was very much one of those moments for me. Anyway.
Yeah. The weird things just keep escalating.
Oh yeah. And like
from there.
Yeah. I mean honestly, the pulling of the esophageal tube to make her die violently with okay, first of all, Rosalind Pike
no,
doesn't
I want to talk about what he does to Venetia.
Oh, okay, fine. Sorry.
Like that's just really jacked, like it's so messed up.
It's such an
interesting transition, because like I said, I actually don't think he means to kill Felix. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a sort of a choice of last resort, if you will, but his choice to convince her to kill herself is like fully deliberate. Yes. And fully
absolutely
horrifying.
I agree.
And yet there's moments where it sort of is teetering back and forth to me.
Yeah.
Like he could almost pull away from it.
Yeah. So like when he first seduces her, I got the impression that although, you know, they were entering into it with a fairly freaky dynamic, where he's like in charge of what she eats, and she's like, yes, be in charge of what
I
eat. I
feel like people in that class raids like to have these weird sort of freaky power things. So
sorry, Emerald Fennel likes that, or.
No, I think just like people. Well, maybe I don't know. There's the like the in that sort of class strata.
Oh,
there's
I see
a lot
what you're
of
saying.
That sort of there's a there's that lot a lot of that sort of power.
Yes.
Weirdness.
Yeah. Think. So, but that's a weirdness that, you know, initially for like I don't know 18 hours does work for them, and I got the impression that he had some sincere affection for Venetia, that went, you know, paired well with his sort of like drive to be in charge of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that Felix, had Felix not waved him off by threatening to withdraw his own affection, I'm curious to know what might have happened.
Because I got the vibe that he was like, it was sort of like a settling thing a little bit. Like, oh, well, I can't have Felix, but I can have Felix's sister.
Right.
Right. Again, another sort of bride's heady sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super bride's head. Super. I was like, oh, yeah. It's Julia and Charles. Okay. Yeah.
Ugh, they're so boring. But also, I feel like I feel really awful for Venetia for most
yes.
of this movie. Like, she seems just like such a. Afterthought in her own
yep.
family, like all the time. Like she's clearly like not
yep.
Felix.
Right. And how could she be, you know? And it's, you know, she, every time someone challenges Oliver in a really specific way, like Farley does it at the party, at the birthday party, telling him how, you know, reminding him of how precarious his situation is. And then after the funeral, you know, Venetia is soaking in the tub miserably and just reveals that she has seen Oliver so much more clearly than Felix ever did, you know, accuses him of always flinching away like a little fucking serf, points out that he'd only known Felix for 6 or maybe 7 months, you know, and sort of saying, what are you even doing here? Like, you barely knew him. He was my brother, you know, like you. What are you doing?
Although that scene did make me think, like, how well does Venetia even
right.
know him?
Yeah, right.
Like, no, Felix.
I know
like,
what you mean. Yeah,
they didn't seem particularly close.
Not super, super close, but like,
I mean, just in the sense that like he's there,
right?
Like he's been there,
yes.
And they have that familiarity of like, you know, growing up together.
Yeah, like
stuff,
I think.
But...
Well, I think there's an ease there. I got the impression that that Felix and Venetia and Farley were. Left to their own devices a lot in childhood. And then of course shipped off to boarding school. But there's a, like, there's moments where there's like that montage where they're all like, they're playing doubles tennis in their tuxedos.
Oh, that's one of my favorite parts of the whole movie. Like, Emerald Fennell just has the most like singular vision for stuff like that. I thought it was all just wonderful to look at. But in that scene specifically, they're all reading Harry Potter.
Yes. All summer long.
Like, and discussing whether or not they think that Harry and Hermione and Ron should be a throuple. But like, they're all reading Harry Potter because you get the sort of sense that like that is kind of the experience of their lives, I guess. Like, they do all these things together, whether they're, you know, posh weirdness or, you know, stunted children's book reading.
Yeah.
Where next?
Oh, goodness. There's so much. Okay, now you can talk about,
Elsbeth's death. Because, yeah, I have to say that scene for me was one of those, again, one of those moments of Rosalind Pike just being amazing. The scene where he flirts with her earlier.
Oh, where he tells her Pamela is a liar.
Yeah, all of the scenes that he has where he's kind of like seducing her without actually seducing her are brilliant, first of all. And her reactions to them of being flattered but also a little horrified but also like turned on because this young man is making her feel desired are all really great.
Well, he's really good. He's really good at projecting back at people what it is they most want to see in him. And, you know, like with Venetia, she wants somebody to tell her what to do, basically, to sort of to give the control over to. And Elspeth wants somebody to like validate her weirdness, basically, because he's like, oh, no, I guess Pamela made up all that other stuff and you sussed it out.
Right. He manages to turn her obvious like insecurity about the whole situation into a compliment to her and her how perceptive she is, and then her response is immediate. Like, she, you know, basically says to him, you know, we couldn't possibly do without you. You're so perceptive, and you see these things.
And she's the reason he stays. She's the reason he stays after Felix dies.
Yes, yeah. But again and again, he just keeps getting the things that he does, outrageous as they are, keep getting validated by members of the family. So he thinks, okay, well, this strategy is working. I'm definitely going to keep doing this.
Yeah. And the final scene where he rips the he turns off the machine and it's not just that he turns off the machine. It's that he then rips out the tube.
Yeah. It's grotesque. It really, really is.
It's so violent and it's so cruel and it's so mean and everything about it is just like, it's like he's so angry at them and hates them all so much. And I just, that scene was so deeply striking to me. I think it's the one of the scenes that just lives rent free in my head. Basically since watching it. And it doesn't help that Rosalind Pike basically has gone around her red carpet looks from that she's been wearing ever since have very much called back to her character. So I have basically had that image of Elsbeth dying in the back of my mind for like a month and a half now.
his rage, Annie, I think you're absolutely right. It is so palpable. Mm-hmm. And actually, as you were describing it, I was picturing it in my mind and I realized, oh, like intentionally or not, this to me is a visual callback to the scene in, and we're going to throw it way back to the first Matrix film now, friends, where Joey Pantoliano like jumps onto Keanu Reeves's lap as he's like trying, as he is doing his villainous monologue about like, how he's, you know, messed with the entire crew and he's going to ruin everything for them so that he can get safely and blissfully ignorantly reinserted into the Matrix. Like, he sits astride Keanu in exactly the way that that Barry sits astride Rosamund Pike, you know, talks in the same sort of mockingly cruel way, you know, and threatens to extubate him. Or not extubate him. He was going to pull the thingy out of the back of his skull. Doesn't matter. Same concept.
Kind of same concept.
Same concept. So anyway, I I just think it's fascinating, like that element of the heel turn is so, you know, it's another moment of him losing control. But in this case, I think he's relinquishing it on purpose because he knows it doesn't matter. There's no one left to seduce or convince or to get out of the way. Farley has obviously shown himself to be the cleverest member of that family by just absenting himself completely. Listen, I respect those survival instincts. None of the rest of them had them. Not that they deserve to die at all, but like he put himself beyond Oliver's clutches.
Yeah.
Whether that was on purpose or not, but I think that a part of it was his survival instinct.
I feel like this particular movie, out of most of the films that have been in awards conversation the past few months, has been particularly divisive. I don't think I've met anyone that has a middle of the road take on Saltburn or moderate feelings about it. People either really like it or really dislike it. And I am wondering why you guys think that is. Like, what is it about this that is like?
I believe that a lot of it has to do with like how you understand the point of the movie. Like, it is a film about class, but it is not a class critique. It's satire, and it is a psychosexual thriller that has in its roots class issues. But Emerald Fennell, you know, incredibly wealthy graduate of Oxford University, she's not, I don't think that she is actually trying to like take down the upper classes herself. That's not what's happening in this movie.
Well, no, I mean, she makes Oliver one of them at the end.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's the things that Oliver does don't, like all the murdering does not arise from like some kind of like class. He's not mad that the aristocracy exists.
Yeah, it's not like a justice for the poor people vibe.
Yeah, no, not remotely. And I mean, I think that gets captured. The essence of that, to me, was captured in what was also for me like the funniest moment of the movie, where Lady Elspeth and Sir James are getting ready to go to poor dear Pamela's funeral, and she's waiting for him on this lounge chair, and a song from like the great like mid-90s Britpop era comes on the radio, and she's sort of reminiscing about having hung out with all those guys back in the day, and says, and then, you know, the song Common People came out, and everyone thought it was about me, and I can't imagine anything more mortifying or more ridiculous. I barely knew Jarvis Cocker. You know, the song opens with the female person in the song. You know, she came from Greece. She had a thirst for knowledge. I've never been wanted to know anything in my life.
She really does get the best lines in the whole movie.
Oh, she does. She does. And she nails them. And I really, really believed that we were going to simply ship her the Oscar like this week.
Right.
I was genuinely surprised when she was not nominated.
Yeah. Honestly, like the thing about this movie is that it was so different from anything I had sat through in years. And that was to me, why I loved it. Because, you know, like one of the things about the, you know, do you love this movie or do you hate this movie? I found a lot of male critics absolutely could not stand this movie.
Interesting.
I mean, I feel like I saw a lot of even gendered dislike.
I know you're right, because I also saw a lot of female critics who didn't like this movie. But I saw an overwhelming number of male critics who didn't like this movie. Everyone I know who liked this movie was a female critic, though there are a lot of female critics who also didn't like it. For me, this movie was just so different from what I usually, from anything I had sat through in quite some time. And it was so whack. And it's also very much not in touch with kind of where we are in the world, in a way. it was just going off on its own drummer. You know, like right now, this is a moment where like unions are the thing and eat the rich is the thing. And you know, like that's what movies are doing, and that's what our culture is doing. You know, we just had a 6-month strike in Hollywood where basically the 8 billionaires were on the back foot from the moment that it started because they are billionaires, and that billionaires are evil. You know, like there was no way they could win in a way because.
Right. I mean, but it's in it's a period piece set in a moment where none of that was on the swiftly approaching event horizon.
No,
like,
that's true.
The most recent Hollywood strike that had happened, in the world of the film set in 2007, the most recent strike of note had been the WGA, which had been brief and it was not a success in the way that this one was. So no.
I absolutely agree. But that my point being is that this movie was so it was so not in conversation with where we are as a culture. It was saying its own thing, having its own point of view, celebrating its own thoughts, and just doing its own thing over in the corner. Like Emerald Fennell was like, no, I don't know. This is what I have to say, and I'm going to say it, and here it is. And I don't care how gross you think it is, or how weird you think it is, or how strangely whack effed up this is. And yes, he's going to have sex with a grave. And yes, he's going to slurp that stuff off the bathtub. And yes, I'm going to make it look artsy as heck when he's doing it because of that whole like water thing with the half cut. Oh, that was so cool. I mean, like, right? Like, that to me is like such a thing that you don't get, you know, most of the time. And for me, like, that's why I loved the movie, because I love movies that don't, that are so determined to say their own thing and do their own thing and not give a damn what anybody else wants them to say or think or do or try to be part of or try to be like in of the moment. Like, I think that's great. And I respect the hell out of Fennell for doing that. And sure, maybe that makes me a sicko because I liked it, but oh well.
Lacey, how about you?
Sickos.
Yeah, sickos unite.
I literally sent the sickos dude to them when we were picking a time to record this podcast. I think I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't want to be the person who's like, I think some people just don't like Emerald Fennell, but I think that is kind of part of it, which I really also enjoyed. Well, enjoyed is the wrong word. Responded to Promising Young Woman, which is different and horrifying in other ways than this film is. But I really like, I don't know, I thought it was a beautiful film to look at, number one. Like, I really think, like, sort of the vision of the film and the vision of Saltburn specifically as a place are gorgeous. Like, I think it really says a lot of interesting things with the cinematography. I think all the actors are great. Like, I really did. I don't know. I think it's, there's something about how transgressive it is that really appeals to me, because I don't know that I hate being this person, but I'm going to say it anyway. I don't know if a male director had made a movie like this, if people would have been so like head up about it.
I don't think so.
And I kind of hate that.
But I also don't think a male director would have. I don't think a male director would have made this movie either. I think there is something.
I don't either. Really, there's something I think specifically like female gazey about this movie in a lot of interesting ways that like we don't normally, because there's just not, we don't normally see, because there's just not enough female directors getting big budget, you know, art house films like this. But I just don't think that people would have been as upset if a guy had made this movie. I don't think a guy would have made this movie exactly the same way, but I think if it had as many sort of scandalous, transgressive elements, it would have been a lot more look how visionary it is instead of look how freaky it is.
Yeah.
And it's fine if you don't like it. This is definitely not a movie for everybody. Yeah. And I can absolutely see like why people wouldn't like it, or why people would be grossed out by it, or why people would feel maybe a little bait and switch about it, because I don't think the marketing materials telegraph how dark it gets.
Yeah, no, there's actually, there's an element of telegraphing sort of a Call Me By Your Name vibe does not, the film doesn't bear that out.
Nope.
Except maybe in the aesthetics, maybe. But yeah, it's, I think for anybody going into the film expecting a class critique, or seeing that in this film, seeing it as an attempt at that, will be disappointed, because that's not what it's doing at all. And yeah, I actually have kind of avoided much, like, you know, Emerald Fennell, except for a bunch of interviews when she was promoting the film, obviously. I just sort of skip over them whenever YouTube tries to encourage me to watch them, because I kind of don't want to know. Like, it doesn't matter. And I guess this kind of goes back a little bit, Annie, to what you were saying about how she was like, well, this is what I'm saying. This is what I have to say. This is the art that I'm going to make about the thing that I'm kind of obsessed with. And there you go. And I think I think that regardless of what she has to say about it, my feeling is sort of like, well, the author is dead. Like, there's no, it almost doesn't matter. And you can have gone into making this film thinking that it's something that others don't see. Like,
yeah.
That's totally fine. It has a meaning for her, obviously. And it can have like a kaleidoscopic number of meanings for everybody else.
Whether or not you meant it to mean X doesn't matter if everybody else sees Y.
Yes.
That is one yeah. truth about art. But the fact of the matter is that this film has such a very strong point of view and a very strong statement in it that it doesn't even matter what I think she has to say about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think a lot of people like projected onto this movie a little bit, like something that they wanted this movie to be.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't know why you look at Emerald Fennell and think, yes, this is going to be like, of course, this movie whitewashes the upper
classes. Of course.
Right.
Like, I don't know why you would look at this film and be like, you know what I'm going to get here is a real scathing takedown of rich people. Why would you think that?
And to be absolutely honest, the fact that Farley's race is the racial elements of Farley's character are completely failed in this movie didn't surprise me in the slightest, because
Felix just like sort of brushes that aside in a very hand wavy way.
Mm-hmm. And because Emerald Fennell has no. She has no interest in racial dynamics, or especially American racial dynamics.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't. Again, I don't know why you would look to this story for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I think it is clunky and unfortunate how bad it is at those issues,
yes.
But I also no one should be surprised by that either.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's a little bit like the Gilded Age trying to do a unionization story. Like, why would you ask Julian Fellowes to do that? That's not even Like, of course, that's not going to work.
Well, then there's so much else going on. I don't know. It's a little like I don't know what they would have like. Where would we have had the time to really do justice to this?
Yeah.
I mean, I think absolutely it could dealt with race and racial dynamics, you know, at all. That would have probably been good. But
I think if you're looking for that kind of film, then one that leaps immediately to mind for me is Belle.
Oh, yeah.
From a few years ago, about a very, very wealthy, like a young biracial Black woman. This is set in the 1800s. Who is very wealthy in her own right through inheritance from her late father. But nonetheless, like, has a very awkward position in society.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's rich, but she can't eat dinner with her family.
Yeah.
You know, that movie, I think, does a much, much, much better job of looking at you know, upper class stuff through a racial lens. And of course, it's no coincidence that the filmmaker is Black. Yeah. Like
I just, Emerald Fennell is not the person who's going to make that movie. And this is not that movie. This is not the movie that's going to, that's going to have that.
I just want to be like, you would not be happy if she made that movie. Like,
anyway, I got final thoughts because we are starting to run really over.
We are. No, I think I have said quite enough words this time.
You're worded out.
Yes, I'm worded out and also don't want to, you know, take up any more time on the mic. I think it's, I'm your guest.
Like I said, I don't think this is a movie for everybody. And if it's not for you, that is okay. Like, but if it is for you, I liked it.
Yeah. And this is one of those things where, like, I really liked going in knowing almost nothing. But I can also see how, like, learning every single spoiler in advance
could really help.
It might actually be helpful. I think it absolutely was helpful for me rewatching it, knowing what I knew.
But I do think it does take a little bit away from the experience of how transgressive it is in places if you don't.
Yeah. Right.
You definitely would not get the "this is what we watched for entertainment in the 2020s.
That is our show, I think. Mm-hmm. As always, Sophie, thank you for joining us.
As always, thank you for inviting me.
To our honorary sicko squad here. Tell the people where they can find more of your thoughts and ramblings on the internet.
Sure. Well, of course, you can find thoughts and ramblings of mine over at televisions.org. And I freelance all around the place, Vulture, Daily Beast, etc. And I co-write a wonderful weekly newsletter of cultural recommendations and criticisms called Two Bossy Dames, which you can find at twobossydames.substack.com.
Huzzah. Annie, you're up.
You can find me at Annie Bundle basically everywhere, on social media, Blue Sky, Threads, anywhere but Twitter, because I don't actually tweet anymore. I am the associate editor here at Televisions, and I also freelance around the web, Primetimer, NBC, etc. If you want to know what I wrote this week, just Google me, because I definitely was ranting about the Oscars. I definitely was ranting about other things. I've definitely been ranting about, I have no idea what I've been ranting about recently. I've been ranting about a lot of things. I'm tired, guys. I've been ranting about the TCAs. There we go. That's what I've been ranting about. Just Google me, find out what I wrote this week, and thanks.
Huzzah, I am Lacey MB on all the social medias that let you pick your own profile name, which is pretty much all of them. If you don't care about any of that, the site and the pod are on social media at Televisions Blog, all one word, on Facebook. If you like what we do, you can visit us at televisions.org and read all of our news updates, listicles, recaps, reviews, and assorted other things. If you do so generously choose to support us, you can also get access to PBS Passport, which has early and exclusive binge opportunities for all manner of programs that are both airing and coming soon, or just online exclusives. I don't know. I can't keep track of how long the list is. I'm pretty sure Annie curates a post about that, so maybe go and check it out. Thanks, as always, for joining us, guys. Sorry about the whole adult content warning thing, but it's an adult content kind of day, I guess. I don't know. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Please watch out for COVID and the flu and all the other nasty sickies that are going around currently. And do something nice for a stranger. It will make you feel better. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.